Thank you for listening to this download of Start the Week, presented by Tom Sutcliffe.
Hello. AIDS is no longer a fatal diagnosis. The Ebola crisis in West Africa has passed, and the World Health Organization recently declared that Zika was no longer a public health emergency of international concern. But that doesn't mean any of those diseases have gone away, or that something even deadlier might not be just around the corner. So what have we learnt from past pandemics about how to survive the next one? With me on the programme today, three people who fought disease on the front line. The AIDS activist Peter Staley, who left a high-paying job on Wall Street to battle for better treatments for people with AIDS. Professor Anne Johnson, an expert on the part human behaviour plays in epidemics. And Professor Peter Horby, who works on ways to speed up the search for a cure for new diseases. Also with us, the writer Louise Welsh, who comes at these questions from an imaginative angle. Her Plague Times trilogy of novels describes what happens when a virulent new illness called the sweats starts to dismantle society. We're starting there with Peter Staley and a known disease. You were an activist, an early activist. You joined ACT UP and later a group called TAG, Treatment Action Group. You had been a closeted gay man working on Wall Street in a very homophobic environment. You became one of the most conspicuous gay men in America. What was the moment that crystallised that change? When did you think, I can no longer battle from the shadows?
Well, my CD4 count made the decision for me. I was foolishly trying to keep my life together with this new diagnosis and pretending that
just,
I could
just explain what the CD4 count is,
right,
for those who don't know.
They were called T4s back then, but it's a key white blood cell in the immune system. They call it kind of the conductor cells. They tell everything else what to do. And HIV specifically attacks those cells and slowly decimates them, leaving you open to all sorts of infections. And that's actually what kills a person with HIV/AIDS. So mine eventually got down to a very dangerous level, and I kind of realized the game was up. So I didn't have a whole lot of time. Made the decision to kind of go out with a bang. Fortunately for me, there was a new movement that had started in New York City to fight AIDS. The gay community rose up, and it was called ACT UP.
You'd already been on the fringes of that, hadn't you, before you made the decision to go public, and very public indeed.
Exactly. I was ACT UP formed in early 87, and I was doing a whole year of being a bond trader by day and an AIDS activist by night, with the two worlds not colliding, I hoped. But once the CD4s crashed, I went on disability. Walked into my boss's office, told him everything, and told him it was my last hour on Wall Street.
And was he supportive?
He was, actually. I told him he could tell the bond desk the next morning, and they heard about it in Tokyo within 60 seconds, and London another 60 seconds later. And it was big news in the U.S. government bond market, but I was out the door, and a week later, I was getting arrested in my first demonstration. So I did go out with a bang.
You were not just a sort of body on the front line or on the barricades. You had financial knowledge that you could bring to this,
right?
Couldn't you as well?
Right. It was helpful to have some of our members not be intimidated when we sat across the table from pharmaceutical company executives and. High-end government officials as we pushed to change the system. And I had that experience in the at JP Morgan of sitting across from corporate executives, and so was not intimidated at all and could make a strong case.
It's a very high-pressure world, bond trading as well. It's a very impatient world. I wonder whether the impatience helped you. I mean, traditionally, patients are meant to be patient. They're meant to do what they're told by their doctors, take the treatment as it's been given to them, you know, and wait to be told what to do. Exactly the opposite happened with ACT UP, didn't it?
Yeah.
Those who were ill said, we're not going to do this.
Well, it should be noted that ACT UP was formed 6 years into the crisis. So we weren't as impatient as I would have liked to see. It took a while for the gay community in the U.S. to rise up and to fight back. And that's because we were such an oppressed community, so hated, so closeted. It took hundreds and then thousands of deaths for us to realize that the closet was going to wipe us out if we stayed in it. So the spark was lit by a speech by Larry Kramer. A group was formed. We took to the streets, and there was no turning back. And it was the first time with our large national demonstrations at the Food and Drug Administration and the NIH that Americans saw large numbers of homosexuals on their nightly news. And we were angry and determined and desperate.
You were desperate, you say. Was there an exhilaration in that too? You certainly took to it. I mean, the film, the documentary, How to Survive a Plague, has sort of multiple scenes of you clambering onto the top of buildings, setting up banners. You look as though you were completely engaged in that battle. Did it have any exhilaration in it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I felt like a kid in a candy shop. We were well organized. We had pro bono lawyers. We had a legal system that was generally handling us with kid gloves because we had a very sympathetic story. They weren't about to throw us in jail forever because they viewed us as desperate people who had a death sentence hanging over us. So we generally just got slapped in the wrist after all our arrests. And I viewed it as a way that I could just go crazy for a day and end up on the news that night being called heroic. So I used to have a blast at those demos.
You had a blast. I mean, that wasn't the full scope of it. And the other fascinating thing about ACT UP and later the TAG as well is the extent to which you tutored yourself in the science.
Right.
Now, was that a difficult process for you, or it was, again, a matter of urgency? You had to do it.
Right. And we started setting up these weekly kind of like science clubs where we did immunology 101 and just got on a very steep learning curve very fast. Some of our members got to the tops of those curves to the same extent that the best scientists were in the country, including Dr. Anthony Fauci at the NIH, etc. It was rather extraordinary how well-informed they became. I only went about maybe a third of the way up the curve, but enough so that I could be effective in the meetings.
I want to open it up to others, but I want to ask you one last question, which is a very interesting sort of movement over the course of the protests. That ACT UP begins by saying we want to accelerate the release of new drugs. We want to sort of break some of the protocols. We want to get the drugs into people fast to see if they work. Towards the end, TAG is saying, hang on a minute, slow down.
Right.
What caused that 180-degree reversal? Was it just that you then knew more about science and knew why the science delayed things sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a part of our learning curve. At the beginning, we were naive in thinking that all of the things we were hearing about that people were finding in test tubes that might or may or may not work, there were dozens of those by the late 80s, and we were convinced that one of them was the cure, and we just had to shake the bureaucracy to get them to approve it faster. Well, it turns out that none of them were the cure, that we had to do a lot of basic research still, and that access wasn't the sole issue that we should be fighting for. It was answers as well. So once we got that balance of fighting for answers and access, we really hit the sweet spot.
Anne Johnson, you were working as a young doctor on an AIDS ward at the time. Did you have a sense of the activism assisting you or being a problem sometimes because of the impatience of people for a cure?
Well, I think I have no doubt that the action of the gay community was unbelievably helpful. I was not working as a clinician on the ward. I'm a public health doctor, so I was studying the transmission of the disease. I went over to the US in 1986, and the US had a much, much bigger epidemic than we did in the UK. And actually, we always benefited from that activity that went on in San Francisco and New York. And I remember meeting some of the activists. I mean, in those days, the focus was, I think, as much on prevention and raising awareness and trying to reduce stigma as it was on treatment, because those were very early days. But I came back in 1986 to the UK and was able to talk about what was going on in the US. And it was very clear that the Terence Higgins Trust here, for example, which was set up as a gay group to really fight the epidemic, had very much was working with the US community to try and reduce the amount of infection that went on and to raise awareness. And we had a much smaller epidemic here in the UK than in the United States as a result. So I would say it was hugely important. I mean, could I just say one other thing about what I think this work's done? In the time since the 1980s, we've seen a really dramatic change in the way we practice medicine, I think, and regard the role of patients in clinical trials. And this is still far from perfect, but on the other hand, I think that's been driven by some of the awareness that was raised by the epidemic. And Peter's very honest here about some of the mistakes maybe that were meant about trying to drive ineffective treatments. And that's the fine balance that we have to strike between protecting people from ineffective treatments or even quack medicine and sufficient evidence to move forward at a sufficiently rapid pace.
Yes, because I mean, there's all sorts of things going on. People will know maybe from if they've seen Dallas Buyers Club, you've got activists who are, as it were, importing medicines that have not yet had approval. That must confuse things enormously if you're trying to do a scientific study of what will actually work.
Exactly.
Peter Wolby, you were working as a clinician, I think.
My very first job as a junior doctor was on an AIDS ward at the Middlesex Hospital just around the corner.
Same one.
And it was carnage, you know, it was absolutely devastating. They didn't have effective treatments and people were dropping like flies. It was awful, and it's great to see that those things have changed. But, you know, we've just been involved in the Ebola outbreak and so many of the lessons have not been learned. You know, we still see that, you know, it's not patient-driven. A lot of the research on neglected infections in low-income countries, the patients really don't have a voice. We've seen with some of the experimental treatments for Ebola the same sort of, you know, problems arising of people rushing to what they see as miracle cures in desperation.
But what would the voice add? I was just going to say, might the popular voice not say, well, actually, there is a sort of magic cure for this? I mean, you know that AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, there are many superstitions about ways to cure it, some of which are fatal and spread the disease further. So there is always a problem, isn't there, in acknowledging the patient's voice?
You have to be careful, and I think one of the main lessons is about, you know, the patients being helped to be educated about the science and actually that you do need the evidence as well as the, you know, the interventions. The WHO were looking at interventions for Ebola and they reviewed over 300. Many of them were crazy ideas, but they were being used in West Africa. Many of them, you know, probably caused harm.
Louise Welsh, I was interested, you both talked about how stigma is actually a vector for the disease, that it facilitates its spreading. That's a sort of feature of your novels too, isn't it? That if you fear the thing, that only creates conditions in which it can spread more easily.
It does, and Anne mentioned stigma. And, you know, I come from a country where homosexuality was only legalised in 1980 in Scotland, which I think we often forget. Mm. So I think the advocacy done by the ACT UP organisation was amazing because people suddenly saw articulate, motivated gay people on television, and that helps to break down the stigma as well. And I was going to say, Scotland is now one of the best places for equal rights for gay, lesbian and intersex people.
Peter Staley, I wanted to ask you, it's a tricky question to ask, David France's book in which you feature about this fight, quotes a Scandinavian activist saying, "I think this has been a good thing for equal rights." He saw a silver lining. Do you think we would have been in the same place in terms of discrimination law, marriage equality, if AIDS had never occurred?
Definitely not. AIDS basically launched the modern gay rights movement. Prior to that, a lot of the national LGBT rights groups played a very inside game. They were very afraid of rocking the boat to create a... They were very worried about backlash. The discrimination was so severe. AIDS kind of forced all that to a head and forced us out of the closet, forced us to find our national voice. And once we did that and realized we had power and that we could change things, there was no going back. And from that moment on, the LGBT community in the States and elsewhere has had a posture of indignation about not being equal. And that posture has served us quite well.
You have, I'm very glad to say, lived to see that. But you didn't expect to. There must have been an immense psychological shock to have had a notion that your life was quite narrowly bounded, and then the combination treatment comes along, and it is almost miraculous in the way it operates. What was that moment like for you? Was it a difficult moment?
Yes, it was horribly difficult, and I think David France writes about it quite well in the book. He says that one of the central themes of his book is about survival and the after effects of that. It was a very difficult adjustment to go from this surreal existence of not having to even think about your future, but living completely in the moment. And then at the same time, you're kind of handed this new reality that you're going to live. The world turns its attention away from everything you've been doing and acts like it's old news and they don't want to talk about it anymore. So it was a huge challenge for many of us, a lot of suffering, a lot of survivor's guilt.
You have to survive surviving as well.
Right. Yeah. But a lot of us persevered as well.
Damon Johnson, part of your work is studying this, isn't it? It's studying how we react to AIDS now and how people behave knowing that there is a treatment and what consequences that has on their behaviour.
Yes, and I think this is a really interesting and it's a difficult problem because, of course, worldwide, the majority of the epidemic is heterosexually acquired, and we haven't talked about problems in much of sub-Saharan Africa. So what has been achieved by antiretroviral therapy, you've heard from Peter, is extraordinary in terms of people being able to live a normal life or a normal lifespan, span, as far as we know so far, getting close to that. On the other hand, of course, we are still seeing a lot of new infection going on, and that's tough too, because people also have to try to not become infected, and that's a complicated business as well. And in the it's great hopes you'll see in many of the AIDS conferences, people wanting to see the end of the HIV epidemic. And there have been hopes that we've been driving down the amount of new infection. But this year's conference was quite depressing on that theme, that although we've been able to increase testing, getting people then into treatment, maintaining them on treatment at a sufficient level because it reduces people's infectiousness to stop the virus being transmitted, we have not been successful at. So in London, I know it may be slightly different now in New York, but around the world, we're seeing in London, for example, as much new transmission going on every year in the last 10 years. It hasn't come down, and it's not dissimilar to the end of the, or the beginning of the 1990s. And that's because we have to continue to take all the approaches we can take together. Rather sadly, people know less about HIV now in the UK than they did maybe a decade ago. That's also true in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So there isn't just one
magic
bullet.
It's lost that urgency.
It's not. Well, partly, of course, public health interventions driven by fear, as we've discussed, people often get frightened of completely the wrong things. But, of course, it was fear of death which drove completely changed patterns of gay sexual behaviour, and though much of that change has been maintained, condoms were not used in the gay community prior to the epidemic. I think that's right to say that's very much maintained. And a lot of people maintain low risk. But on the other hand, there are people who don't realise they're infected and may be transmitting virus. Yeah.
You were involved in, I think, the first national survey of sexual attitudes and lifestyles back in 1990. Why was it so important to get that information, and how difficult was it to get it?
Well, we simply had no idea how far HIV would spread. We didn't know the proportion of the population who had had same-sex relationships. It became evident there was a heterosexual transmission going on, and we didn't know anything about how many partners people had or their sexual practices and so on. Very little was known. And of course, studying that was also stigmatised. And you can see the prejudice within...
Just explain, why was it stigmatised?
Well, it was stigmatised. It was interesting that the epidemic was seen primarily as other. It was something that was happening amongst gay men, you've described the stigma, people who inject drugs and so on. And it was okay for us to study the lives of gay men, study the lives, sex lives of women who had who were paid for sex. But once it came to studying the general population, that was seen as quite different. But it was very clear we needed to know that, and we needed a proper random sample survey to work out how far this epidemic might spread so we could try and control it and put in the right education measures. And that proved to be actually much, in a sense, easier to do than anybody imagined. Once we went out and did the survey, people, provided you gave the serious basis, did the right research to ask the questions properly, people were as happy to answer questions in the right protected format, a professional and scientific format, as they were to ask questions about any other aspect of their lives.
There's another difficulty with the study of behaviour, isn't there? Which is that if you put behaviour at the core of the causes of the disease, you open a door for blame, culpability. And this was something that happened in New York, I think, that there was a real debate about whether behaviour was at the centre of this and whether people should change behaviour, right, having fought so hard, as it were, for the right to behave in ways that they wanted to behave.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult issue, that, isn't it?
It is extremely difficult, and that was the whole point, to avoid stigma and to, in a sense, normalise the discussion about sexual behaviour.
You say avoid stigma, but, of course, in a medical sense, you have to stigmatise some kinds of behaviour, don't you? You stigmatise them at the very least by saying, these are unsafe.
Well, that was a very big debate that went on, and that's why it was so important that the gay community were involved with that, because actually what the gay community did was to change the cultural norms in the interests of self-protection.
That didn't happen without a fight, though, did it?
It didn't. I mean, the only government response we were getting was, they shouldn't be having homosexual sex. And we had to save ourselves, and we came up with the terms safe sex or safer sex as soon as we had the evidence that condoms blocked HIV. We started advocating for condom use. We learned what sexual practices were safe and what were unsafe, and we self-educated on those, and we saved tens of thousands of lives by doing that.
Peter Horby, this is an issue for you as well, isn't it? Human behaviour and its interaction with a virus and a disease, something that's entirely sort of clinical.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I started my clinical career with, HIV-AIDS work, but moved on to other more acute infections. So I've been involved in SARS and bird flu and now Ebola. One of the challenges we have is that, if we want to test the vaccines and the drugs, we can only really do it in the midst of the epidemics, and that's often the hardest time to do it because there is so much fear and so much stigma, also a lot of politics involved, particularly with infections that cross boundaries and there's travel restrictions, and countries are often rather reluctant to be fully honest about what's happening within their countries.
You did this recently in West Africa with the Ebola breakout. You tried to get a clinical trial up and running. You got halfway there, didn't you? You got it started, but not quite finished. Why was that?
We got all the way there. We actually did two trials.
Right.
So we set up one trial, but that was stopped very quickly because the drug company withdrew.
And why did they withdraw? Because I think that takes us to the heart of some of the problems here.
Well, it's not entirely clear, actually. There is there were some discussions between the FDA and the drug company, and the drug company decided to withdraw. We had declining case numbers. That was one of the reasons. But this was a small biotech company that had one drug that was actually developed for a different indication. And for them, it was a financial risk to be involved in this Ebola trial. And I think that, you know, was a big issue for them. And they were in a position where the entire livelihood of the company was, you know, may have been prejudiced by being involved in this trial.
So you're dealing, I mean, you were on the ground in West Africa. You're dealing with that, which is with decisions being made in America and decisions in part being made by the FDA. At the same time, you're having to look for a hospital that, you know, actually has concrete floors so that you can reasonably do the work you need to do.
Yes, we had to go on a... at the time we started the trial, MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, was really running 90% of the treatment centres, and they arranged for us to do a grand tour. So we went round 6 different Ebola treatment units in West Africa across the 3 countries trying to find a site where we could do a clinical trial. We wanted to run it to international standards, so that was a big challenge when you're trying to work inside a tent. You know, I think one of the things we learned is you can do it. You can innovate and you can do high standard drug trials. But you do need to not cut corners, but you do need to really telescope what's normally done. Often these trials take, you know, a year, 2 years to even set up. And you just don't have that time in an epidemic. You really have to act within a period of weeks, not years.
Can you, as it were, pre-pack a trial so that you can have it ready to go at the moment of emergency? Or is that a complete misunderstanding of how these things operate?
You can, but it's not been done. I think this is one of the disappointments is, you know, we know we're going to get epidemics of various infections. You know, they're going to come. The UK's, you know, biggest risk on the risk register is pandemic influenza, but we still don't have a good treatment for severe influenza. We should be ready for these things. But, you know, once the problems go away, then people forget about them and the investment moves, etc. We should have had, you know, vaccines on the shelf and drugs on the shelf for Ebola. It's been around for 40 years and there's been, you know, 2,000 plus cases. We should have been ready to go, but we weren't. And so I think that's the lesson for the next time is we need to have everything ready on the shelves, the protocols ready, and all the legal agreements in place so the drug companies are comfortable to go forward with trials at risk.
You say we should have that. Is anybody working on making that happen?
Yes, we're doing work on that. We're working on pre-prepared protocols. There's new initiatives have come out about trying to identify the top 10 infectious disease risks for large outbreaks like Ebola, and then looking at trying to find ways to incentivise the drug companies and the vaccine companies and the diagnostic companies to develop those products to a stage where they've gone through all the safety testing, we have clinical trial batches ready to go into studies as soon as there's an outbreak. Because what we learnt from Ebola was even though we were quick, we managed to telescope the trial down to, you know, 6 weeks from starting, you know, to getting funding to enrolling patients. We were still at the end of the epidemic and we had to be even quicker than that.
Were these trials randomised trials that you were running? And then perhaps you could just explain a little bit this real crux, this kind of ethical crux, which is that you can be at the height of an epidemic, you can have a drug which you think is effective. The scientific way of testing that may involve not giving it to people, or does involve not giving it to people. And that's a really difficult thing to do at the height of a crisis, isn't it?
It is. I mean, with an acute crisis like that, we were in the situation where, you know, ZMapp, which is one of the drugs that was, you know, likely to be most effective from the experimental models, was being given to repatriated Ebola workers who'd gone back to the US or back to the UK. And that drug was not available for anybody in West Africa. When there was enough of it made to start a study, then it was only going to be available on a randomised basis. And the question was, well, you tell us you don't know if it works, but you're pumping it into every, you know, expat who goes back to Europe, so you must have some confidence in it. And the same with convalescent plasma. We flew, you know, a recovered UK citizen all the way to the US, got him a special visa to give convalescent plasma to an American. But we weren't prepared to do that in West Africa. We said, oh, we need a randomised trial. So it is hard to explain the need for randomisation.
And what is the defence for randomisation, which means you that some people just get a placebo, you know, so that you can test it? What's the final argument? What's the ethical argument rather than the scientific argument for doing it?
The ethical argument is that's really the only way that you're going to get a definitive answer to know whether this drug really works and is also not harmful as well. And so you have to do it, but it is a It is a difficult thing to explain or to justify sometimes. And I think there are there's a move towards more, I think, nuanced types of trial design. The one we used didn't start randomised. It started with a phase two where we had, which is a trial where you don't randomise, but we had cutoffs to say, so you, it looks really effective.
Yeah, you take a group of people and you compare their survival rate
to this, to the historic survival rate, or the, you know, people that in a different treatment centre. But there are all sorts of potential biases in that. And we used that as a first phase, and we were then going to go on to a randomisation if we showed that the drug was safe and had some impact.
In the West, we, I think, naturally tend to think of science, people in white coats, laboratories as our first port of call in a disease. Are there behavioural things? You tell a very interesting story of crossing a border in West Africa, and there's a man at the border, and he's supposed to be taking temperatures to make sure the disease doesn't spread. He doesn't have a thermometer. He just looks at you and guesses and writes that down. Now, that presumably, that very, very low-tech response might be much more influential than a complicated laboratory.
Yes, I must say, you know, and he did have a gun as well, so we were even sweating when he was looking at us, guessing that we all had a temperature of 37 and we weren't going to disagree with him.
But am I right in thinking that you can do much more kind of low-key things?
This is part of the dilemma, I think. You know, that kind of border screening actually doesn't work, but there are other interventions, you know, like contact tracing and advising people about, you know, early symptoms and getting early diagnosis and certain ways to avoid transmission really works. And there was an argument during the Ebola and other outbreaks that we shouldn't be wasting our time and resources on doing science. We should be just doing the public health measures. But, you know, I disagree. You know, it's we never move on otherwise. We just implement the public health measures. We never learn about the vaccines or the diagnostics or the treatments.
Anne Johnson.
I mean, I think it's actually the issue is about doing them together, because the tendency, of course, is to ignore the public health measures and go for the science. And actually, we never solve these things with one magic bullet. It's putting the things together that's so important. And in the end, the public health response, as we well know, in response to the Ebola epidemic, and Peter's much better able to say this than I, was very slow. And that's what allowed the epidemic to get a grip. That's not to say for the next epidemic we do need to be ready with drugs and vaccines, but you need to get the public health bit right as well in order to integrate the whole lot.
It's an odd mixture of slowness and rapidity, isn't it? Because yeah. I remember when Ebola first cropped up in America, there was an almost instantaneous panic and instantaneous reactions. Were you depressed by that, Peter Staley, having lived through one of these great crises, to see the way in which Ebola was reacted to in America?
Yeah, I was horrified by it. It reminded me very much of early AIDS. And AIDS activists, actually, the old-timers like myself, we went into high gear when some of our politicians started acting like the politicians were in the 80s. New York State Governor, New Jersey's Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo in New York State both tried to impose quarantines on healthcare workers returning from Africa against the CDC's advice. And
Centers for Disease Control.
And
yeah.
we started fighting against those efforts and gave them quite a black eye in the American press for taking those steps.
Quarantine, it must work sometimes, but it also creates a panic that, as it were, can spread a disease.
That's really interesting. I mean, if you look at some of the accounts of the historic accounts of the plague, you'll see people being put in quarantine and jumping out the back windows of the houses in London and going out, of course, spreading it into the countryside. And so the same, there are many, many examples of that. It creates fear and people hide. Peter describes that beautifully in the Ebola epidemic, plenty of examples. So it hasn't been very effective.
Louise Welsh, this is absolutely at the core of what you're writing about in some of the books here, that people will conceal their symptoms, they will hide the fact that they're ill, they won't seek treatment, and that naturally spreads it.
Of course, and I was thinking when I was writing these books, I was thinking very much about responses to the Black Death and people who become very, very religious and think, well, God is furious with us, we must go around the countryside flagellating ourselves. And of course, as they do this, they're spreading the plague as well. But that lust for life that makes people behave badly, but also makes them behave well. And I'm writing about a plague where Anne and Peter, you know, aren't there and everything is broken down scientifically as well. But it strikes me that there are people who run away, but there are also people who run towards the disaster. And that's part of what I'm exploring within these books.
It's something about, I mean, you're not the first writer to be drawn to the idea of a pandemic. It's a very deep kind of notion and a deep fascination for writers. Plague literature tends to face two ways, doesn't it? It faces towards the things we value in society, but it's also looking towards the weaknesses of our society, the things that are going to break down almost immediately.
Sure, and I think any book actually that's writing about the end of a society is also some kind of love letter towards it, saying, look at this great thing that we have, we don't want to lose it. But of course, in the first book, I'm looking at things like bad pharma, the idea that drugs may be available and yet they're too expensive for particular people. And that idea for us in Britain, it often seems that these things happen yonder awa'. You know, it's happening to somebody else. It's happening to the gay community. It's happening to people in Africa. And I wanted to have something that hit at the heart of so-called respectable society as well.
The implication of the books is that xenophobia and violence and apocalyptic religion, all of these are like dormant viruses. You know, they're there as long as society is functioning well and is robust, they don't express themselves. But the moment we get into trouble, they emerge again.
Well, that's why we fear just now, isn't it? And I think when we think about the language of plague, the language of virus and the language of infection, writing these books, I had to be very careful because that's also the language of the far right and the xenophobic. So when people talk about swarms of immigrants or whatever, they're using the language of the plague. And I wanted to write books where everybody is displaced. Everybody who survives is displaced. And I'm nearing the end of this trilogy, and the idea of guilt and survivor guilt, and how does one progress when everything else has broken down, is very much a part of that.
I don't know whether we've all been guilty. I certainly have been guilty of using the metaphors of war in talking about this, and battle. And I just wondered from all of you whether you think, I mean, particularly epidemiologists, is that actually useful, or is it a damaging metaphor?
It's. I mean, the whole narrative around, you know, is now around health security, around a lot of, you know, epidemics. And on the one sense, it's good because all of the Ebola vaccines and drugs were pretty much developed based on US biodefense money, because Ebola's on a list of biological terror threats. But that whole narrative is dangerous as well, because, you know, then it's the funding only happens if you think it's a national security threat, and there isn't that issue of, well, actually, it ought to be a social solidarity with people in other countries, and we might ignore that if we're only worried about our own security.
Professor.
Yes, I think Peter's absolutely right. If you see it as a... You need the metaphor, if you like, to get people galvanised, but what they don't do is they don't continue working at it, and it tends to reduce cooperation. So people always blame one another for their... somebody else for their epidemics. The French... we blamed the French for syphilis in the 15th century, and the French blamed somebody else. So we're always trying to protect ourselves. Do you see this in the Ebola epidemic, with people having irrational, completely irrational fears about people from Sierra Leone, or irrational fears about men who have sex with men, rather than building a long-term integrated response between the various systems we can use, which is all the way from critically the vaccines and the treatments alongside community engagement and functioning health systems, which of course have been a major problem for many of these epidemics.
Well, that's something you address, Peter Horby, that the sort of most basic level, you need a functioning health system in a country to deliver cures. And
well, I mean, also to prevent epidemics, you know, it's not a random chance that West Africa was where Ebola got out of control first. You know, those are war-damaged countries with extremely poor infrastructure and very poor health systems, and that's why it got out of control. And, you know, if you really want to be able to respond quickly, you have to have a good health system in the first place to identify the threats quickly and be able to manage the patients and their contacts and families.
Louise Welsh, at the end of the, there's an afterword at the end of your first book, A Lovely Way to Burn. And you say, while I don't exactly look forward to the end of the world as we know it, the knowledge that it may be just around the corner probably enhances the way I live. I wondered whether that was a bit of a self-indulgence. Can you only think that because you don't think it's around the corner?
Possibly. I was very struck listening to Peter and watching the film How to Survive a Plague, when people ask, how do I live now? And I think perhaps that's a question that we should all be asking ourselves. We only have this one life. How are we going to live it? And the idea that drugs are so horribly expensive and that that precludes some people getting treatment, not just for HIV, but for cancer and all sorts of diseases that affect us all, seems a terrible thing to me. And my great hero is Robert Louis Stevenson. His father and uncles developed lamps that saved countless lives in the lighthouses, and they did not charge for it.
OK, we're going to leave on that high note, I think. Thank you to all of my guests, Anne Johnson, Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at University College London, and Professor Peter Horbury, Director of the Epidemic Disease Research Group in Oxford. Peter Staley's story of AIDS activism is told in David France's book, How to Survive a Plague. And the first two novels of Louise Welsh's Plague Times trilogy are already published. The final part is going to be out in July next year, I think. It's all going well, is it?
Yes, it's almost finished.
As long as you don't fall ill. Next week, Kirsty Walk will be exploring revolutionary fervour from the Levellers and Joan of Arc to provincial England. But for now, thank you and goodbye.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.